KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for tuning in, again, to Hearsay Culture and tuning in to KZSU. Today, I'm very excited to have on the authors of the book Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics. The authors are Morley Winograd and Michael Hayes. And I'll discuss their background, and I'll actually ask them shortly to discuss their background in a little more detail. But the book itself, and the subtitle suggested, takes a very close look at the current generation of voters. That is, voters that are young people that are coming of age now. I'm amazed to say these are people that are a bit younger than me, so as I continue to age, but people that are coming to start voting now and what that generation is about. And one of the big focuses of this book, in fact, the major focus of the book, is the impact of technology, but not just the impact of technology on politics and the way political campaigns are run generally, but also the impact of technology on the way these young voters think and the kind of things they may respond to and ultimately what motivates them. The book itself covers a wide variety of areas through a number of anecdotes and also through the backgrounds of the authors, which I'll discuss in a moment. Another great focus of the book is history, and the history of primarily national elections and also congressional elections, and attempting to draw some very interesting comparisons between the elections that we're currently facing in 2008, as well as upcoming midterm elections in 2010 and the presidential election in 2012, and trying to see if there are, in fact, any parallels between the events that are impacting political behavior today and events that occurred in the past during presidential election years primarily. And that history is fascinating and an area particularly where I think the contributions are quite valuable. So I'm very excited to have on the authors of Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics. Morley Winograd is the executive director of the Institute for Communication Technology Management at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business. He also served as a senior policy advisor to the vice president and Al Gore during the second term of President Bill Clinton's administration, focusing, and we'll discuss this a bit, focusing on Vice President Gore's Reinventing Government initiative, which I was personally fascinated by and a big admirer of those efforts. Mike Hayes served for a decade as Vice President Entertainment Research and for more than 22 years overall at Frank & Magid Associates. This book is really a book that I would highly recommend to anyone interested in where elections are going today, but also with respect to technology, for technologists who are interested in taking the perspectives of people that don't focus on technology in the way that technologists do and write on a daily basis, and yet the conclusions that they reach are very far-reaching and I think very valuable for the technology and technologist community generally. So without further introduction, hopefully I've done my job correctly. Morley and Mike, are you there?
We are indeed.
Happy to join you, Dave.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being on the show, and thanks for taking the time. Let's start right off. I mentioned your backgrounds briefly, but I think it would be helpful for the benefit of the listeners to describe your backgrounds a little more in a little more detail, and ultimately how you came together to write this book.
Well, you mentioned my this is Morley. You mentioned my service with Vice President Gore. That came about through a book I co-authored, not with Mike, with another gentleman up in the Bay Area by the name of Dudley Buffa, which was entitled Taking Control, Politics in the Information Age. And it was published in the mid-90s, and Vice President Gore and President Clinton both admired the book and wanted some of its ideas brought into the administration, which is how I ended up as his senior policy advisor. But the book thesis was that technology has a very important impact on voters' values and perceptions of how the world works. And at the time, we coined the term wired workers to try and describe that, although obviously in today's mobile environment, we might not use that same wired term. But the notion was that people coming to work in new environments with access to information at their fingertips, the ability to connect laterally to members of their team, would impact their the way they thought about politics and the approach they took towards candidates and political parties, and a lot of those ideas were incorporated into policy ideas not only of the Clinton-Gore administration, but the Democratic Leadership Council as well. However, Mike and I, and I'll let Mike jump in here in a second, Mike and I have been friends for enough years for him to both do the polling and survey research work that identified these wired workers for us, but also for him to later conclude and get me to conclude as well that technology wasn't the entire answer and that there was another key element of the shifting values of American voters that had to do more with generational change than it did with technological change, although, as you said at the beginning of the program, those two changes are inextricably linked, and as we document just how linked they have been in American history in this new book, Millennial Makeover. So it's been that conversation among two friends. We've been friends for 30 years, and we've had a lot of chance to talk about politics and constituents and voters that generated some of the ideas for this book.
Hmm. And my background, this is Mike Hayes, is I guess one could say I've had three aspects to my career. The first one was I taught political science at the University of Detroit in Detroit, Michigan, primarily American government, political behavior, and that's where I met Morley in the early 1970s. I guess by the time I met Morley was toward the end of the 1970s. And work with Morley in the second phase of my career, which was conducting political polling, political surveys in Michigan primarily for Democratic candidates, Carl Levin's first election, Jim Blanchard's first election as governor. And then in the early 1980s, I moved to Iowa and went to work for a company, Frank and Maggot Associates. That is a market research and consulting firm in the communications industry, initially primarily broadcasting, and to a large degree what you see on television news is a creation of Maggot Associates. But we also did a fair amount of work in the area of entertainment programming, and more recently, as the broadcast industry has matured, the company has been heavily involved in doing work on in various areas of the new technology, and has an initiative, the Millennial Strategy Program, with which I was involved, that studied this new large generation of Americans, the millennial generation. And that is where Morley and I began to think about the possibilities of working together and understanding the importance of this generation as a source of attitudes and beliefs and ideas, and also as a prime user of the new technology.
It's a fascinating area, and I know from my own experience doing volunteer work and in the 90s working on a volunteer basis with the Democratic Leadership Council, both when I was a legislative aide at Albany and just getting to know the New Democrat Network as well, that this has been a focus not just, of course, of the Democratic Party, but really of both political parties in the United States, which is to figure out ultimately what this new generation of individuals are thinking about and how technology impacts their behaviors and vice versa. And the point that Morley made with respect to almost a which comes first, I think, is an interesting one that we should talk about. But I do think up front, and it's something you address in the book, and I want to give you the opportunity to address it here, based upon your political backgrounds, I think it's a fair question to ask, and again, I do think you address in the book, although you've worked with Democratic Party affiliated or advocates of the Democratic Party, your effort is a nonpartisan effort. In other words, this is not a book designed to drive the interests of a particular political party, and I want to give you the opportunity to address that point up front.
Well, I think that is certainly true. I believe that by my background in political science and academic research, and Morley's as well, we have viewed this book and viewed our efforts as an attempt to understand current trends and so on, regardless of where they may lead in a partisan direction. We obviously bring our own political beliefs, our own political perceptions in as Democrats, and indeed there's a lot going on in the current environment that would seem to be of benefit to the Democratic Party, but we certainly spend time in our book writing about how the Republicans can take advantage of these trends as they develop. And it's still an open question as to which political party, which set of political beliefs is going to dominate the political process in the coming decades.
So in order to sort of reflect the values of this millennial generation that we're writing about, we almost start the book with a upfront declaration of our political background and activity to provide as much transparency to the ultimate writing as we can. And as Mike said, in the course of the book, we demonstrate that these kinds of generations that the millennials represent, this civic kind of generation that comes along about every 80 years in American history, is not automatically a Democratic or a Republican generation, nor do liberals or conservatives necessarily carry the day in a civic era. It really depends upon the political party and the candidates and their courage in embracing a new idea and a new set of beliefs.
And that's, I think, where we're going to dive in next. And I guess I should also say, although I think I just gave the caveat, I did volunteer in the 90s and into 2000s as well with the Democratic Leadership Council and then with the New Democrat Network. So
for some Democrats, that doesn't necessarily make you a Democrat.
That's right. Yeah, I did discover that. Well, I made my fortune worse in that regard by simultaneously and being even more involved with the Concord Coalition.
Well, there you go.
So that was that was certainly enough blasphemy for one day, and I remain actually still involved with Concord's activities. So I fully put myself out there as a friend to no one, it appears. So I guess
well, I don't know how that looks on your Facebook page. We'll talk about
fair enough. You've spoken a bit about your background. I do want to now get into the book, and I think we can also morally work in some discussion of your efforts with Vice President Gordon reinventing government. But let's dive right in and start really with the title of the book. When you say millennials, what do you mean, and what are the characteristics of the millennials?
I'm going to let the survey research expert who's looked at interviews from thousands and thousands of millennials answer that question. Mike, why don't you go ahead?
I will do that. First of all, just to define them in terms of basic demographics, millennials are Americans, young Americans, who were born from 1982 through 2003. They are the largest single generation in American history. Currently, there are just under 100 million millennials in the United States, and that would comprise around a third of the total U.S. population. And about a third of that 95 or 96 million millennials will be eligible to vote in this election. And that would give the millennial generation numbers equal to, if the millennials vote in large numbers, as we expect them to, equal to those of senior citizens, of people 65 and over. So they are a group that has certainly tremendous potential in American politics. In addition to being the largest generation, they're also the most ethnically diverse generation in American history. They are comprised of about 40% of millennials are non-white, either African-American, Latino, Asian-American, or mixed race. 20% of them have at least one immigrant parent. They are also a generation that is the least bound by sex or gender role differences. They really, as a generation, don't see huge differences in what they expect males and females to be able to do, to be able to accomplish. And that is demonstrated by the fact that a majority of college students and professional schools, majority of professional school students, for the first time in U.S. history, are in fact female rather than male. And all of this is reflected in their political attitudes. They tend to be, as we would define the term, liberal in their economic beliefs. They believe in an activist government that tries to resolve political issues, economic issues, matters of that type. They are very tolerant on social issues such as gay rights and issues of that sort. And this has in turn led this generation to identify itself as Democrats by roughly a 2-to-1 margin, and to be the first generation in U.S. in the last three or four generations in which the greater number of its members consider themselves to be liberal rather than conservative.
Hmm. It's the numbers are fascinating, and the raw numbers strike me, Mike, when you mention these numbers. And again, it really harkens me back to a lot of discussions that Cocker Coalition and others had raised in the 90s, and certainly late Senator Tsongas did, about the concern about generational warfare on certain policy issues. And in light of, and particularly the focus, of course, was entitlement reform and Social Security concerns about how those would be focused on. I don't want to discuss Social Security reform here, as fascinating as it is, but I do want to discuss that issue of generational warfare. And I guess I'll ask you a question of demographics. Your sense of the behaviors or the thought processes that this new group of voters are entering into would suggest that perhaps we have, to put it broadly, a greater opportunity to deal with issues in a way, or political and particularly difficult political issues, in a way that perhaps we haven't had in a very long time. Gentlemen, what's your sense of that?
I think that's true, and I think while a number of us were very concerned in the 90s about this intergenerational debt load and how it would be played out in American politics, and a number of people forecasted that the Social Security debate would turn out to be the first hot button center of that kind of divisive debate, we actually haven't seen that and aren't likely to see it, and it has to do with the way this millennial generation was raised. So the reason that there are generational types and a cycle of four different types in Anglo-Saxon history, which is described better than we ever could in the book Generations by the late William Strauss and Neil Howe, the reason that occurs is that we really haven't settled as a culture on how to raise children. And the only thing we all agree on is that we're not going to raise our kids the way we were raised. And so we have these constant cycling through of ideas on child rearing that affect very much the people who are then grow up and mature and base their worldview on what they learned from their parents and the events that occurred during their teenage and early 20 years. In the case of millennials, they get along very well with their parents because their parents decided to raise their children as their friends, not with a heavy-handed discipline, but with a lot of rules that were subject to negotiation and conversation, but were nevertheless social rules that needed to be adhered to. But in the course of that, it was done in a way designed to build friendship as opposed to distance or stern remoteness. And so today, half of millennials talk to their mother every day. 80% of them report that they're in conversation with their parents in the course of a week. They have a desire to involve their parents in their own decision-making process. Millennials rely upon their friends, literally friends and also social network-level friends, for information and ideas and look to form consensus in how things should be handled. But in that circle of friends, and certainly in the larger circle, are their parents. And so I don't think we're going to see the kind of intergenerational conflict that the debt policies of the country might otherwise encourage. Instead, I think you'll see millennials looking to find win-win solutions, the kind of solutions that Barney taught them were the good ones, where everybody wins at the end and everybody feels good about it and everybody is treated fairly. I think they're going to be looking for that kind of solution to the challenge that you raised and the Concord Coalition is rightly focused on as they grow up and as they enter the political debate.
And going even beyond that, this is Mike again, going even beyond that, as Morley mentioned, William Strauss and Neil Howe have developed a typology of four archetypical generational types, one of which is the civic type of generation. That's what the millennials are. And the civic generations tend to want to build and improve upon and strengthen governmental institutions. They also are a generational type that is actually willing to make some sacrifices of its own in order to resolve issues. And one way in which they have done that in the past is they've actually been willing to tax themselves at higher levels than other generational types. So while there may be these budgetary concerns, it is not unlikely, and indeed based on history, it is likely that millennials will be willing to tax themselves at reasonably high levels to avoid just some of the problems that that have been discussed that would lead to the intergenerational warfare.
It's a very optimistic view, which I'm pleased to hear, and it reminds me of some of the conclusions that Fareed Zakaria has reached in his new book, A Post-American World, about really an optimistic view of where we're headed. And I think that that's good, and it leads me to, before we get into some of the history and some of the more detailed discussion of your book, it leads me to the logical question of how does technology, in your view, impact these behaviors of these millennials? And it's almost like I mentioned earlier, a chicken and egg question. Is it the technology, in your view, that is driving these behavioral changes, or is it something else?
Well, the technology throughout American history has enabled a dynamic generation. There are two types of those generations. There are civic dynamic generations around the revolutionary times, around Civil War times, around the Great Depression, and now with the millennials. And they're also an idealist generation, a type that the baby boomers are probably most representative of in today's terminology. But in both cases, these generations come along in about every 40-year cycles, alternating between the two of them. And they have the technology is critical to their ability to think in a particular way, to have enough of a common characteristic of attitudes and beliefs that they can be characterized as generational attitudes. So for boomers, it was television in FDR's days, the GI generation, the last civic generation. It was clearly radio. You go back to Lincoln's times, it was the penny press and the ability to communicate news across telegraph lines that enabled that generation to communicate in a new way and come to a new conclusion about what America should be. So the technology is an enabler of the ability of this generation to mobilize, and in this particular generation's case, as reflected in the title of our Millennial Makeover book, you have these social networks which allow them to talk and stay in contact with constantly, thanks to the Internet, all of their friends, and we use that term liberally here, of course, to include anybody that they are interested in communicating with.
Right.
Now, that technology, to sort of clarify that the relationship between the technology and the generational attitudes, that technology can be used by other generations to accomplish similar things, but it ends up being used in a completely different way. So the best example from this year's political environment is the outcome of the Ron Paul efforts to use the same Internet technologies as Senator Obama did to organize in the campaign. But Senator Obama's message was a message of community and unification and hope and optimism, which is very much in line with the millennial attitudes and beliefs, whereas Ron Paul supporters tend to be much more Gen X. That's the generation between boomers and millennials, and this is a generation that because of the way they were raised, has a very skeptical, sort of entrepreneurial, risk-taking, but cynical attitude towards a society, not particularly interested in participating in community kinds of efforts, much more individualistic. And so Ron Paul's effort, while it raised some money and got him some notoriety, didn't translate into votes because there aren't the quantity of Gen Xers as there are of millennials in the first place. And in the second place, he didn't attract this new Internet group because his value set was so completely different. We think that the technology enables a generation to form its attitudes and beliefs and has an influence on the kinds of attitudes and beliefs it has, because obviously, as we all know, IT architectures tend to be reflected in fundamental values and perceptions of how the world works, mainframes being considerably different than client-server and completely different than, again, from a web-based, a more open, what Lessig would call read-write culture, I guess. But despite the fact that there's that mega trend, at the within that trend, there is also the use of the technology that is so reflective of attitudes and beliefs, and those are much more generationally determined than technologically determined.
The book is Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics. The authors, Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes. We have a few minutes before we take a short break, gentlemen, and I wanted to ask you kind of almost utopian question and see how almost ask you how far your optimism reaches. And you mentioned Professor Lessig, and as you know, he's recently started his effort through an organization he's calling Change Congress, whose modest goal is to change the way politics operates in Washington, and particularly to change the way policy decisions are made through the influence of money and what have you. I'm of course speaking tongue in cheek. It's a massive goal, and I'm curious to know. I mean, a cynical view would say, "Oh, that can't be done, and we've tried it before, and it's not possible." Does your optimism or your belief, perhaps to put it more directly, your belief in the values and decision-making process and the way millennials think suggest that this may really be, for the first time in a long time, a really great opportunity for that kind of massive effort to be successful?
Well, it certainly does, and of course it wouldn't be the first time. The FDR New Deal looked impossible, and in fact, in its progressive ideals and the way it implemented a strong central government to take over the direction and success of the American economy was a debate that had been going on for 30 or 40 years before the New Deal as progressives attempted to try and make that happen. But once the GI generation, the last civic generation, was in the voting population and ready to throw their weight and their numbers in support of it, it did happen. And you know, similarly, nobody thought, in the 10, 15 years before 1860, that America would reach the resolution of the fundamental question of slavery and states' rights in a way that was so transformative of America, but it did. And so, yes, we do believe these kinds of sweeping transformative changes do occur and that we are in a moment in which they are likely to occur.
Hmm. Let's take a very short break. We're talking with Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes, authors of the book Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and a Future of American Politics, published by Rutgers. At the bottom of the hour, for those of you that listen regularly, you know that I will now ask you for money. But I ask you for money not for me. I'm asking you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to keep its diverse programming going. And I should emphasize the point that for those of you listening by podcast, you also benefit from KZSU's existence, as Hearsay Culture's home is KZSU and will remain the home of Hearsay Culture as long as that is possible. And I have no intention of changing that. So to the extent that you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can either email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can click on Donate to KZSU at KZSU's website, which is kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to keep listening. So, gentlemen, we're back, and let's dive into some of that history, because I think it's fascinating, and I think it's of particular value for those of us who think about technology to really constantly take a look back in history and see where those parallels are, and perhaps even from a technological standpoint or technologist standpoint, remind ourselves that things have happened before that we might think are new. You focus your attention on the realignments, as you call them, of 1860 and 1932, among others. But perhaps we could start there. What's significant about those two realignments, and how do they parallel to today?
Well, this is Mike. They parallel to today in a number of ways. The primary way is that we describe them in the book as what we call civic realignments. And those are realignments that are produced by the type of generation we refer to as a civic generation. They are realignments or makeovers. And by the way, a realignment is nothing less than a complete transformation of the political system, the political process. It usually results in a new majority political party. It results in new ways of doing things politically. it results in a complete transformation of public policy from one direction to another. And the ones in 1860 and in 1932 were civic realignments. They resolved, first of all, huge political issues that had been bedeviling the country for decades earlier. Morley mentioned the resolution of the slavery issue in the as a result of the 1860 realignment. The in 1932 it was bringing the government into the economy for the first time in large measure as a guider of the economy. They produced new majority political parties in 1860, the Republicans, and 1932, the Democrats, who then dominated the political process for the next 40 years beyond that. And both of those realignments were produced, or at least guided, they were produced by the rise of a civic generation, the most recent one in 1932 by the GI, or Greatest Generation, but both of them were also helped along the way by the development of new technologies, new communication technologies, telegraphs, the penny press, which allowed mass persuasion across the entirety of the electorate, and then in the 1930s, radio allowing political figures from a central location to talk to the entire population at one time, something that had never been able to be accomplished before that, and so they did permit large mobilization of the public. And finally, they did both produce large new institutions of government for their particular eras.
And I think just to underline this realignment or makeover phenomenon, what happens is you have a generation that is fairly united in its beliefs in the case of civic realignments. And they are united and unified to some degree because of their ability to communicate with each other, share ideas, and come to common conclusions. Now, to a degree that conclusion is led by the articulation of a vision such as Lincoln's vision of a unified country, a union, rather than a country that was divided within itself. And, of course, in FDR's vision of the four freedoms that he enunciated as the central to the New Deal's policies, those kinds of powerful ideas can unite a generation if heard by a generation of sufficient size, and these generations are large and very motivated to participate in politics.
The history, I think, is illustrates, I think, a key point that I want to dive into today. And you mention in the book the failures of the Hoover administration, which are well documented and which we don't need to get into here. But suffice to say, to put it very simply, and I apologize to historians listening, but the failure to comprehend the gravity of the economic situation that led into the Depression. And I want to ask this question this way, because obviously in the United States we have a presidential election coming up in a matter of months. And it would seem, and you seem to suggest in the book, but I want to discuss in more detail, that a failure of the new president, whoever that person be, to comprehend not only the technological changes, which are fairly well documented, but the demographic changes, which your book illustrates so clearly, would be a colossal failure and a major concern for us. What's your reaction to that statement? Is a comparison to Hoover in that unfortunate event an accurate one?
Well, now you'll be accused, you'll help your listeners accuse us of being biased Democrats. So I'm going to take the Democratic side, and I'll let Mike defend the McCain Republican side of that question.
Fair enough.
On the Democratic side, in the primary campaign, you saw one candidate, the eventual winner, Senator Obama, fully understand the generational change that was occurring and leverage it and leverage the technology in order to form a campaign strategy that assumed his opponent, Senator Clinton, would have the support of the existing elites and governing structure of the party. I might add our friends at the DLC included. And so in order to sort of take on that bastion of strength, he deliberately cast himself in the role of a different generation, of a person coming from a different perspective, not just using the technology. And my Barack Obama now has a million friends on it, and you know, all the text messaging to organize the caucus voters and all the wonderful ways he understood the technology. But as early as over a year ago in March of 07 in Selma, Alabama, where Democrats gathered to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the most decisive moment in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the attempt to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge to in Selma in order to advocate the right to vote. The two candidates, Clinton and Obama, were there. And Clinton spoke in very much boomer language about the different groups, women, African Americans, even Latino, Hispanic Americans in the case of Governor Richardson, who were now carrying the banner that was first bloodied in this great moment in boomer history of the civil rights movement. And Obama, who is also a boomer by age, a very edge of the boomer generation, but still born within it, deliberately did not take on the mantle of that generation, that kind of idealistic attitude towards politics, and instead said that while that was like the Moses generation in the Bible, that did great things, wonderful things, and helped in expand freedom, that he himself felt more a member of the Joshua-type generation, which is, in fact, in biblical terms, this civic archetype, which united in its efforts to conquer and build the new government in Palestine, the new state of Israel, and did so in a unified way by blowing down the walls of Jericho. And it was that kind of effort, that unified institutional building effort that he associated himself with. And so very clearly from the beginning, Senator Obama has understood these generational and technological changes and is the nominee because of it. Now, on the Republican side, you have a different story, but Mike can tell that one.
Well, the Republican story, I think, is, in fact, in some ways a little more complicated. Dave, your question kind of looks forward to what would happen if either Obama or, in the instance of the Republican, McCain, were not to respond to it, to the generational or technological changes. But in effect, the historical analogy, looking at Herbert Hoover, was actually looking backward. He was unable to see the changes. Hoover was unable to see the changes coming his way that came to a kind of a culmination during the Depression. And so, to one degree, you can almost look back at the Republicans and say that George Bush is perhaps the Herbert Hoover of this particular era, because he was unable to see, or seems to have been unable to see, many of the changes that were moving ahead in America at this point. Looking at McCain, our belief is that, in fact, that John McCain is probably, of all the Republican candidates that ran for the nomination this past winter and spring, may be the best positioned to be able to deal with these changes in a positive manner. For a variety of reasons. One, his national security credentials. Millennials are indeed a very security-conscious generation. They are a generation, for at least at this point, that 9/11 was a major, if not the major, traumatic event of that generation, just as Pearl Harbor might have been for the GI generation. And his credentials in that area do offer the Republicans some help. But that isn't the only issue, and it may not be the most important issue that the electorate is going to be dealing with this year. And so the other issues of importance would be those dealing with matters of the economy, with a receding importance of social issues. If John McCain is to get ahead of those issues, he will have to essentially lead to a rebranding of the Republican Party as a more progressive force than it has been over the past 40 or 50 years. And so the real issue becomes, I think, whether John McCain, whether his fellow Republicans, will allow that to happen. There seems to be some real question about that, and it's a major struggle that he has been fighting. It does appear that, at least to this point, he has spent much of his time trying to consolidate his conservative base, which would lead away from the possibility that he is going to be able to realign the Republican Party in the direction necessary.
And I would say two other things on the McCain confronting the economic challenges and understanding the technology. Of course, we recently had the statement by his person in charge of his online campaigning that Senator McCain, despite the fact that he doesn't have a computer or use a computer, gets the concept of the Internet, which is not a great way to start embracing the impact of technology in American life. But he's also a member of the silent generation. This is the generation that followed the GI generation, preceded the baby boomers. It's not a very important generation in American history. It's a type of generation that is not usually doesn't usually have a big impact. But this one has even less impact because it is the only generation in American history never to have elected one of its own as a president. And John McCain represents sort of that last chance. And you see in a lot of his behavior an attempt to bridge differences, which silent generation types like to do, and find ways that demonstrate independence and yet loyalty and patriotism. A lot of silent traits, unfortunately, there are not a lot of silent voters. The numbers don't work in his favor in that regard, and so he may have a harder time comprehending the changes that are now occurring in America or what needs to be done about them.
And if I could just add one other thing, and that would be that if you do look at least at this early point in the campaign, the polling does suggest that there is going to be some very clear generational voting in this election. Obama leads among millennials and the very youngest members of Generation X, which is the next oldest generation, by about a 2-to-1 margin over McCain, where McCain's support is strongest, and he doesn't lead by 2-to-1, but maybe 1.5-to-1, is in fact among senior citizens, those 65 and over. Hmm. And then in between, essentially the older one becomes, the more likely they are to vote for McCain. So at least at this point, it does appear that the tide might be on the Democrat side, if nothing else.
And I should know for the benefit of listeners that we're recording this interview on July 2nd. So as you're listening to it, that is the date that's being recorded. We have about 10 minutes left, gentlemen, and I do want to ask you a few questions about focusing in on the technology and millennials. And one of the areas that is written about more and more is this notion that while technology is great in terms of sharing information and allowing individuals to collect it and create and share, and Morley mentioned Professor Lessig's read-write idea, and it's also colloquially known as Web 2.0, there's also a growing amount of literature making the opposite argument, that in fact technology, and more particularly the kinds of commons creation technology that allows people to post stuff to YouTube and Facebook and MySpace and other kinds of internet resources with which you make mention in the book, that it ultimately leads to a dumbing down of culture and a dumbing down of knowledge, and that this generation is actually suffering from the unedited internet that allows anything to be thrown up there. What's your sense of that argument? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Is it more nuanced? What's your take?
Well, first of all, a lot of the conversation is a generational conversation. It is historically true that older generations have always looked upon younger generations as less educated, less understanding of how the world really works, in their words, and less willing to consider the opinions of their elders. That's sort of a traditional dynamic between generations, and particularly in this kind of transition to a civic generation from an idealist era. But the specifics of this technology, because again, these two subjects are so intertwined, really is a very interesting one in this sense. What the internet allows you to do is take advantage of what Sarwecki calls the wisdom of crowds. So Wikipedia, Google, and those kinds of technologies allow you to know what everybody thinks, or however you define everybody, very quickly. And what millennials have found or have become accustomed to as they've grown up is to look for that opinion very quickly and to settle for that opinion and to disregard or at least discount the opinions of experts and other elites. It sort of began when the elites tried to take away their music with the Napster lawsuit. So they became very suspicious of people who said, this intellectual property is mine and you have to pay to understand it or share it, when so much of it was available for nothing. And they found that information to be, if anything, more believable because it didn't come with a commercial agenda attached to it, or at least, or even a political agenda. So in that sense, it's not so much a question of dumbing down as it is looking for alternative sources of knowledge. And of course, it strikes experts and elites as a dumbing down because they think they have the knowledge and other people don't. My favorite example of all this is the one that Mike uses, so I'll steal it from him, which is if you were to ask a millennial what they think of a movie, they're much more likely to go to Rotten Tomatoes and look at the aggregate opinions of everybody who commented on the movie than they are to quote you the opinion of the critic from the New York Times or wherever the current elite set of movie reviewers reside.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not relevant to them because those people aren't like me. And if they're not like me, then how do they know what I should think?
And it's funny you mention that because that's actually exactly how I measure movies when I make decisions, and I'm older than a millennial generation. So a plug for Rotten Tomatoes, I suppose.
But you are a technologist.
I am a technologist, so I'm in this unique group of strange and odd individuals.
David,
yes.
Just one real brief aside here. This isn't the first time in history we've ever had this debate. Medical science really didn't start to advance in the time of the Renaissance and beyond that until it put aside the old ancient texts from back in ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and began to examine issues empirically. But the medical establishment in the Renaissance said, well, you've got to look at the text. You've got to look at what Galen said. You've got to look at what Hippocrates said. And rather than simply, it was really kind of an earth-shattering occurrence to begin to empirically look at people who were ill to be able to do vivisecture or that kind of thing, just to be able to see what was really going on in the case of disease, rather than simply going back and looking at the old experts who had been running the roost for many years and for many centuries had been wrong.
And if it strikes you that surely that's not, that millennials don't think about current expertise as being as wrong and as ancient as the Greeks, you have another think coming. That's exactly how millennials think about experts.
Hmm.
Old fuddy-duddies who think they know something, they really, when I know something better because I can experience it on the net.
You know, there's a, and I just saw this yesterday, there's a posting on one of the blogs I read that posted a video that apparently the California Department of Motor Vehicles has put out to encourage the exact generation that you're suggesting, in fact, maybe a few years younger, but certainly, the age of individuals who are going to take their driver's test, to study for the driver's test not by going to the books, but by watching videos on their iPhone.
Exactly.
And in fact, the video actually sets in, I think, a pejorative way the idea that you would go to books. Which I thought was fascinating, and it was tagged with the heading "Librarians Look Away," as a joke to what was being done there. But that's exactly the point you're making. So it's an interesting point. We have about 5 minutes left, and of course, at this time in the show, I invariably ask a question that is virtually impossible to answer in the short amount of time we have left. And so I'll attempt to truncate a little bit this way. But I guess my broad question is the issue of transparency, what we think of as having a clear understanding through sharing information from government so that individuals or citizens can understand what's going on. And without getting too theoretical in our remaining minutes, I guess I'm curious to ask you the question this way. Can or do you think will the prevalence of sharing information by means of the technologies that we've discussed today with millennials ultimately have a potential impact of on the decision-making process of government. In other words, John Elster wrote about the humbling power of public humiliation. And I guess I'm curious to get your sense. Will millennials, or how do you think millennials will react to getting that kind of information from government? Because oftentimes we hear the response, well, it's great to be transparent, but voters are apathetic. What's your sense of this generation?
From my reinventing government background with Vice President, just jump in here a little bit. We will have a dramatic increase in transparency in government. And the notion that that voters are apathetic simply does not apply to millennials. No civic generation is apathetic. Voter turnout rates are double, triple, quadruple in some cases in primaries. Among young people, the GI generation voted at twice the rate that their older generation did. So civic generations, forget apathy. They're very involved. Then if you plug in the technology of transparency that allows people to publish and discuss and debate on their own without the filtering effects of elites, you have an opportunity to transform governmental decision-making. In our book, Millennial Makeover, we talk about one early example of that, which occurred in the high-tech, if not liberal, state of Utah, around a website that I think was called Politicopedia.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the both sides of the debate in the Utah established a site in which citizens could comment on the legislative debate and provide their own facts and opinions. And the outcome was very positive and very optimistic for how this might work at the federal level and will, in fact, take place at the federal level as we advance. And that is, in one case, the opinions of the citizens produced a more, quote, liberal outcome. And in another case, it produced a more conservative policy outcome.
Hmm.
But in both cases, it produced an outcome that was more in line with what the public was saying and wanted to see happen based upon this interaction on the net.
The book is Millennial Makeover. The authors, Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes, the publisher, Rutgers Press. Gentlemen, for those people that want to learn more about your book and about your work, obviously you have the book, but where else would you suggest that they take a look to?
Well, people can certainly go to our website, which is www.millennialmakeover.com, and we describe the book. We also, they can certainly see videos that we have done, see book reviews, op-eds we've written, and a variety of different kinds of things, so they can learn pretty much, I think, anything they need to learn about this book, and hopefully it'll inspire some people enough to want to read it.
We have some current blogs on that website as well as on our own blog spot. And you can find us on a channel on YouTube, a group on Facebook, and a page on MySpace as well if you really want to get into Millennial Makeover.
Terrific. Well, gentlemen, I certainly, first of all, have enjoyed the conversation, and thank you for being here. And I invite you back perhaps after our presidential election, so sometime early next year, to perhaps to discuss the outcome and see where we're headed.
We'd be delighted to do so.
Indeed, we would.
That would be terrific. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
The book is Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics. The authors, Morley Winograd and Mike Hayes, from Rutgers University Press. Upcoming on the schedule are a number of interesting guests that we have coming, actually focusing particularly on technology. Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody, will be on to discuss his work, which is receiving a lot of attention. I'm also excited to mention that David Rice, who wrote Geekonomics, will be on the show to discuss his views of that really fascinating area. We are also going to have on Mark Bauerlein, author of the book The Dumbest Generation, apropos of previous conversation, who has a decidedly different view of the impact of technology on people today than the current authors who are on today, as well as many other guests of the show. Nick Carr will be on towards the end of the year, the author of The Big Switch. I'm also excited to mention that we are also I'm actually very excited to mention that Paul Ohm, as well as Ned Snow, Natanael, who has a new book coming out called Copyright's Paradox, as well as David K. Levine, no relation, of course, but another David Levine out there, which many listeners, of course, will be familiar with, and Michelle Beaudrin, who have a book coming out called Against Intellectual Monopoly, will be on the show. So there's a wide variety of guests coming on, all of which you can read more about and find out the schedule by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule. As always, there are a number of ways to pick up Hearsay Culture. You can listen clearly on KZSU FM when the show airs live on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. But you can also pick it up by podcast through hearsayculture.com. You can subscribe to the RSS feed there. You can also pick up the show through iTunes and Stanford Center for Internet Society's podcast page by typing Center for Internet Society in the podcast search engine. Or you can go to CIS's webpage itself and subscribe to the RSS feed there. And that web address is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Also, as always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, future guest suggestions, any other thoughts, ruminations, concerns, criticisms by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you again for listening today to Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.